Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by 360 Cookware, green USA-made cookware that is a delicious, healthier alternative to cooking with grease. For more information, visit 360cookware.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton coming to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, in beautiful Roberta's Restaurant. And I'm really excited today because we have a very special guest. Missy Robbins is one of my heroes and should be for many aspiring chefs. I hate to play the woman card. I usually never do. But I'll go out there and say there are very few women who are picked as rising star chefs by Food & Wine magazine, and very few women who get a Michelin star. And Missy has just taken both of those accolades. She has proven to the world that she's among the best and the brightest of chefs that we have today, and she has an extraordinary story on how she gets there, and she's real. We're going to talk real here. Welcome, Missy.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
I should mention that you're the executive chef of a Voce restaurant here in the city with two locations, one at Columbus Circle and the other one on East 26th Street and Madison Avenue. But before becoming the executive chef in 2008, Missy was the executive chef of Spiaggia in Chicago. And at that stage, Spiaggia, under her leadership, was nominated for an outstanding restaurant award from the James Beard Foundation. That's another one of the biggies that you can get. I don't know what other women have really got that kind of nomination. And so I just got to ask how you got to the top. And we're going to start with right from the very beginning. You're a Connecticut girl, eh?
I'm a Connecticut girl. I grew up in North Haven, Connecticut, in Cheshire, right outside of New Haven, and grew up in a family that was really, really into food. And everyone always said, oh, was your mom a great cook? And she'll kill me for saying this, but I've said it over and over. She's really good at traditional Jewish food, and the holidays in my house were always awesome. But really where my love of food came from, and the love of the restaurant business and my fascination with the restaurant business came from my parents taking us out to eat a lot. I have a brother, and we traveled a lot when I was a kid, and we grew up about an hour and a half from New York City, and we always spent big occasions coming in to see a show and then going to fancy restaurants, as I used to like to call them.
What's your first fancy restaurant memory?
I think the Four Seasons. The Four Seasons, Shunley Palace, Le Gav Roche when I was 12 in London.
Ooh.
That was a really big one, because that I can remember everything I ate. I mean, from start to finish. It's really, really bizarre. So I think I'm sort of meant to maybe do this. But
So tell me, as a 12-year-old eating at Le Gav Roche, what impressed you? What were the impressions?
I think it was always, for me, it wasn't just the food. It was the environment and the fanciness and the lighting and the service and sort of being taken care of and getting I was kind of a you know, I was a tomboy and I didn't love getting dressed up, but I liked getting dressed up to go out to eat. And I liked that whole idea of that and the activity of going out to eat. I was a really picky eater. I mean, I remember sitting in the Four Seasons and with my dad, and we always, I always wanted to share the rack of lamb with him, but I always wanted mine well done. And he's like, that's not going to happen. And I wanted everything on the side. I wanted all my vegetables on the side and sauce on the side. I mean, I was a horrible eater, but as my dad still likes to tell me today, I always pick the most expensive thing on the menu, always. And still today, when we go out to eat, he said, why is your part of the bill always twice to three times as expensive as everyone else's?
Tell them it's investment grade.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, I think that's really where it came from. And, you know, I grew up in a home where college was a non-negotiable. And, I mean, it wasn't even something I thought about or didn't think about. You just went to high school and then you went to a good college and then you graduated from college and you went to work. And, my father's a physician and never pushed my brother and I in any direction. It was just that the education was really important to them and that was very much instilled in us. And so my parents luckily never said you have to be pre-law or pre-med or pre-anything. They just said go get educated. And
so what did you want to do?
A variety of things. I mean, at one point when I was very young, for some reason, I wanted to be a divorce attorney. I had friends whose parents got divorced, and I was fascinated by the fighting in the home. Seriously, true story. But that was never a consideration later. I was a psychology minor and an art history major. I thought I might want to own a gallery someday. I was a photographer as a hobby.
So wait, so you had both sides of the brain, because psychology is science and art history is fine art.
And guess what? As a chef, you need both sides of those brains, because I spend half of my day using psychology.
Yes, I bet.
Really, I mean, really managing it when you get to the level where I am and you spend, I manage 70 people between the two restaurants and so really the managing part takes my psychological side and but the art side was always, you know, I decided early on I didn't want to be a photographer and that wasn't something that I wanted to pursue and but I really liked art. And then sort of when I got through art history and I got through college, I realized that I didn't want to go to grad school for art history and that it was a little too intellectual for me and I didn't have that side. But I liked the gallery idea and kind of coming up in the gallery world is not so different than coming up in the chef world. I mean, you do a lot of apprenticing and you don't make a lot of money and you kind of need a lot of money to open your own gallery.
And you need a lot of business expertise,
right,
aside from just the
So I did the internships. I worked at the Jewish Museum in New York under the chief curator when I was in college for one summer. And I did an externship at a photography gallery in D.C. when I was in college one summer. And I took photography classes. But I didn't – the chefing thing to me, I thought that I'd go do something. And I don't know what that was. And open a restaurant in my 50s as a hobby once I made a lot of money doing something else. That's just what my brain said. And I don't think in my day, I've been doing this for 20 years now, cooking wasn't what it is now. And it wasn't like you were this girl who went to Georgetown and became a chef. That's not, it wasn't cool. It wasn't hip. It wasn't the celebrity.
In fact, it was looked down on. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah. So, I mean, and going to my parents and saying, you know, I think I'm going to become a cook was definitely a really, it was in my head very difficult. The reality of it was they said, great, go try it.
Really?
Yeah, my parents are really, they're super supportive. Like I said about the education, I mean, it sort of goes hand in hand. They always said, we don't care. You want to be an English major, be an English major. You're going to get the tools, whether you know, their analytical skills or writing skills or whatever those are, right, you're going to get the tools to succeed. And they were really intent on that, which I think is really interesting from someone who is very directed in their profession.
Yes.
But, you know, my father put himself through medical school and through undergrad, and he was, you know, we were fortunate. He didn't make us work through college. They wanted us to very much focus on our education.
So at what stage did you work after Georgetown, or did you go right to culinary school?
I worked during Georgetown. So the story goes, I'll give you a brief version. my family, my mom's side of the family is from Chicago, and we were in Chicago during Thanksgiving of my senior year. And I had heard that a friend of mine from elementary school was who had gone to Northwestern was working at Charlie Trotter's doing an apprenticeship. And I said, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. And we went to Charlie Trotter's to eat over Thanksgiving weekend, I think the Saturday. And we had this incredible meal. And I said, okay, I'm done. This is what I want to do.
Really?
Yeah.
Thank you, Charlie.
And so I contacted this woman, Megan. She's very successful in her own right. She's worked for she has her own business now, Megan Conway, but she worked for Charlie Palmer for years and years as his pastry chef in Vegas. Oh. And I think she's gone out on her own now. She's been very successful. But I called her, and I said, oh, I want to work at Charlie Trotter's. What do I do? I'm going to write him a letter. She said, great, write him a letter. He's never going to respond to you. She said, I live here. I walked in the back door. I was very persistent. And at the time, I was still in college. So I went home and I wrote this long letter, which I still have. And it talked about passion and eating in all these fancy restaurants. And I'll do anything and I'll work for free and I'll do whatever you want. And it was a Thursday night and I had a beer in my hand and I was getting ready to go out. And it was before cell phones. And my roommate called upstairs and said, hey, some dude, Charlie Trotter's on the phone for you.
Oh, my God.
I said, huh? And so I went in my room, my little tiny college room, and I picked up the phone, and he basically, gave me this crazy interview. And he said, look, you have no experience. You're welcome to come out here for a stage. I don't even know if I knew what that meant. And why don't you come out here? But in the meantime, I think you should get some experience in D.C. while you're finishing school. And why don't you go talk to Jean-Louis?
Oh, my gosh. So was he going to give you an entree to Jean-Louis?
Or? No. He just said, go talk to Jean-Louis.
But, of course, you dropped Charlie's name when you went.
No. Oh. I went and I trotted down to the Watergate and I left my resume.
Jean-Louis Pelladin.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I had no idea. I didn't know what the business was like. I didn't know anything about it.
Did you know who Jean-Louis was?
Yes.
You must have,
I knew because I lived in Washington. Yeah. And so I went and dropped my resume. And a couple days later, Jean-Louis called me and said, I mean, at the time, I didn't think it was like, I didn't even know. So he called me and he said, I'm really sorry. I don't have any room in my kitchen, but thank you.
He called you to say he didn't have any room, not to interview.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
Right.
The head
I
guy,
miss those
the
days.
Iconic chef.
Hey, guess what? I still call every applicant.
You do?
Almost every applicant.
How
yeah.
inspirational that
Almost
is.
Every applicant. Some of them don't even know who I am. They just have applied to a Craigslist ad, to be honest.
Wow.
But some of them were like, wow, hi, chef. Wow. I call almost every applicant myself, if I have time.
I have a feeling you're going to get a flood of applicants.
I hope so. Please.
You were
please.
Just saying, we'll get to that
I
in the later
so.
Part. She needs chefs out there. She needs chefs.
I did go out and stage with Charlie for a couple days. It was terrifying.
Why was it terrifying?
Well, I had never been in a kitchen. His staff was pretty intimidated by him. So they'd sit and they'd be shooting the shit with you and they'd be asking you questions and you'd start to talk and they'd go, shh, here he comes. And you just wouldn't, it was terrifying. But it was really fascinating and really cool. And so I went back and I said, okay, well, what am I going to do? I really want to try this. And he kept saying, you have to get some experience before you finish school. And it was February, graduate in May. And so I went, there's a restaurant called 1789 in D.C., a classic D.C. restaurant. It's above my college bar called The Tombs, where I spent about 4 to 5 nights a week hanging out. And the chefs were very cute guys who were always hanging out in the bar. This is a true story. So I put on a cute little outfit, and I went and knocked on the door of 1789 one afternoon. And I said, I really want to cook. I'll do anything. I'll work for free. Do you have anything for me? And he said, sure, you can work every Friday and Saturday night. We'll pay you.
Wow.
Because I think they were corporate and they kind of had to. And he said, you can work every Friday, Saturday night. I said, Friday and Saturday night, I'm a senior in college. I'm about to finish school. And again, like I said, I wasn't someone who I was fortunate and I didn't have to work.
Right.
And I said, all right, fine, I'll try it. So, I didn't know you needed your own knives. I didn't know anything. So I showed up to work and I loved it from the very first second.
Tell me how standing that long in a kitchen that first night?
It was awesome. I had so much to do that I looked at my watch at 6 to make sure I was set up, and I looked at my watch again at 11:30. when we were done. Yeah, it was, and it was like that ever since.
What did they have you do the very first day you were in there?
Clean greens and cut tomatoes and really basic things. And I ended up, the garmanger guy didn't show up the next night. And guess who worked garmanger?
No, the second night you were
there.
Yeah,
one of the sous chefs helped me, obviously, because I know. And this was a restaurant that was fine dining,
yes.
And did 300 covers on a Saturday night. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was so energetic, and I was now allowed to go through the back door down to the bar, so I didn't have to wait in line anymore. And I would go downstairs, and my friends were at the bar. So there was like a double, you know, it was a double bonus, sort of, and I couldn't wait to go back. And I ended up working there through the rest of the year, and I kept in touch with Charlie, and he wouldn't give me an answer. And I kept calling and saying, so are you going to hire me? He said, oh, keep in touch with me and I'll let you know. And I was getting antsy. I had plans to travel in the summer to Europe. And the agreement with the parents was that I did have to work after that.
Right.
So I went to the guys. The guys were teaching me so much at 1789. And I went to them and I said, you know what? I'm really learning a lot here. Can I stay? I said, but here's the deal. I'm going to Europe for 6 weeks. And they said, yeah. They said, go eat, taste food, come back, work in August. So I left for the summer, and I came back, and I worked there for another year.
Wow. And what stations did you go through?
I did garmanger, I did hot apps, I did a little bit of pastry, tiny bit of pastry. And then I left. It was like about, I was about to probably move to Entremet, and then I left, and then I had decided that it was time to go to New York, and that if I was going to take this seriously.
Okay, we're going to stop there because we have to take a break.
Great.
But now we're going to come back to New York when we come back.
Today's program has been brought to you by AmeriCraft. AmeriCraft and 360 Cookware are proud sponsors of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. AmeriCraft is an American company, and like Heritage Radio Network, they provide the best. Their 360 Cookware is made of the highest quality ingredients, like United States steel. It is made in the greenest cookware manufacturing plant in the world. AmeriCraft makes great cookware and is focused on improvement. 360 Cookware is their exclusive line. It's a contemporary line of cookware and bakeware intended to let you, the Heritage Radio Network listeners, have a unique cooking experience. Its vapor seal allows food to be cooked in its natural juices, preserving all of the vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients without added water, oils, or fats. 360 Cookware invites you to learn more about how this process works on their website, www.360cookware.com.
Well, welcome back. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and you're listening to Chef's Story. And today I have the Michelin-starred Food and Wine Best Rising Chefs, Missy Robbins from Avoce, with me. And we've just gone through her journey to entering the chef world, and now you're entering New York City's chef world. Tell us about that.
I decided I really wanted to come to New York, which was never really in the plan. But a lot of my friends had moved to New York after college, and I started visiting more, and I was like, this is pretty fun. And I really knew that if I was going to take this seriously, that I needed to be in the best city to cook, and that I needed to be with the best chefs. And I'm a little super driven, and to say the least, I might be a little bit of an overachiever. So I really wanted to be with the best of the best. And I was sort of deciding how to do that, because it's still the rule now that you should work in a place for at least a year, but back then it was taken much more seriously. And I knew that I didn't want to come take a job and not go and not finish that year if I hated New York. So I decided to go to school. I took the summer and I went to the Berkshires and worked at a beautiful, beautiful hotel called Wheatley.
Oh, yeah.
Really fancy, really, I mean,
A mansion
with really incredible food, and really, really technical food. And I worked Garmanger there for the summer, and it was a really fun experience. And then I went to what was Peter Kump's at the time. It was a little townhouse school. And because I had cooked for almost 2 years already, I thought that it was sort of better for me to go to a shorter program.
Why did you feel you had to go to culinary school if you worked
well,
2 years?
Part of it was the moving to New York. I was really scared to move to New York, and I didn't want to leave a job after 6 months if I didn't like New York. Mm-hmm. I ended up staying in New York for 9 years before I left, so that didn't end up being a problem. But I had been in this kitchen, and there were a lot of things I hadn't gotten to do yet. I had never made stocks because I wasn't on that part of the kitchen. There were just things,
holes.
And I thought that it would fill in some of those holes and mm-hmm. just sort of make me a little bit more comfortable in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it would make me a chef or make me an expert. I just thought it would make me a little bit more comfortable, mm-hmm. Which it did. Mm-hmm. It turned out it made me a little more comfortable, and it was sort of a 4 month vacation, if you will. I mean, I went from working a lot of hours to working. 9 to 5 at school and having this weird sort of 9 to 5 schedule, which I hadn't had since I graduated from school. And it was a fun period, but I was definitely like very eager for school to end and to get back into a working environment.
So where did you go from school? You got an internship?
I did my internship with Wayne Nish at March, which I loved, and it was really incredible. And you know, one of the reasons it was cool when I interviewed with him, because I had cooked, I was sort of worried about not getting to do enough in an internship. And when I interviewed, I said, what do your interns do here? And he said, well, some of them work stations and some of them sit in a corner for 6 weeks and pick herbs, sort of up to you. And I'm in addition to being an overachiever, I'm a little bit aggressive. So I put myself on a station on day one, and I worked Garmanger during most of my internship.
He must have been impressed with all the experience that you had.
I think he liked me. We had a good rapport, and he was really helpful. He didn't have any positions open. My internship was only 6 weeks, and he didn't have any positions. And I went to him with a list of restaurants that I was interested in, and he kind of directed me and said, I don't think that's a good fit for you. I think that's a great fit. And I ended up at Arcadia with Ann Rosenzweig, which was really cool.
That was one of those seminal restaurant kitchens that many people came out of,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Anita Lowe, who also has a Michelin star, right? She was...
I don't know if she actually worked there.
Oh, really?
I actually don't know, but okay. Rebecca Charles.
Rebecca Charles, yeah.
I'm trying to think who else was there. Jennifer Sism, who opened Anissa with Anita,
right.
But she was doing the front of the house at that time.
Right.
There were great people there, and that was a really special kitchen. And,
yeah.
And I had read Anne's 3-star review when I was at 1789, and I said, this is who I want to work for. So
was
I sort
it important to work for a woman and see a woman chef? Did that play into it at all?
It wasn't. I mean, I think, yeah, I could sort of relate to her background. She was extremely educated. She was an anthropologist. She was Jewish. I think there were some commonalities that I related to in her, and I think I saw this successful woman. I don't know that I thought that at the time. I was 24 years old, and I don't know that I was processing it in hindsight.
You just loved her concept of restaurant.
I liked her concept, and I think I probably liked that she was a successful woman. She was in her 30s at the time, I think, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
She was tough. She was really...
Really? What was it like?
Oh, my God. I got yelled at every day. For not being set up on time, for being too slow, for whatever a cook yells at. The same thing I yell at my cooks for now. But I remember, a really funny story. I used to go to the sushi. I worked lunch for a good part of the time I was there. And it was my first real line cooking job where I was cooking fish and meat. And, it was a new experience for me. And I remember I went to the sous chef every day, and I said, is Anne coming in today? And she'd be like, yeah, it's her goddamn restaurant. Of course she's coming in today. And I was, like, terrified. And I just remember a couple times, I mean, where she would just have my head. And but she liked me. She was also very, very, very nurturing to me. I mean, really, really nurturing. But I think because she liked me, I got it a lot because she wanted me to succeed. But I remember the sous chef kind of walking across the line and being like, hey, give her a break. Like, she's a new cook. And I remember, like, a very specific day that happening and the sous chef sort of protecting me. But Anne was really pivotal in my career and really gave me that opportunity. And
so how long were you there for?
I was at Arcadia for a year and a half.
And then what?
And then I went back to March. I had really felt like I never finished my time there. And I really...
What does that mean?
You know, you get into a kitchen and you can't... I see this in cooks a lot today. They work 6 months and they say, oh, I can't learn anymore here. Well, what do you mean you can't learn anymore here? You've worked on one station or two stations. For me, I was an extern with Wayne and I loved his food and I loved him and his philosophy and his demeanor in the kitchen was really amazing. And he was so smart. I didn't understand most of what came out of his mouth. He's a really intelligent guy. And I just felt like I didn't get the whole picture. I was in the little garmanger corner most of the time I was there. And even though it was a small kitchen and I'm an observant person and I could see a lot, I never felt like 6 weeks is really a short time in a kitchen. And he called me and said, I have an opportunity. And do you want to come back? And I jumped at it. And I remember having to tell Anne. And I remember she was like, kept avoiding having a conversation with me. And she was going on vacation. And she's going out of the country. And I said, Anne, I really need to talk to you before you go away. She sat me down outside at Arcadia. They had a little patio. And she said, where are you going? And she made it really easy for me. I said, I'm going to go back and work for Wayne. And I went back and it was great. And I worked Garmanger there and Hot Apps. And Hot Apps was the coolest station there. It's where all the foie gras came from and really great ingredients. And at the time he was doing all tasting menus and it was really challenging. And he let people create their own tasting menus. So you could have a table of four people doing four different tasting menus. It was fascinating. Mm-hmm.
How long were you there?
I was there for almost 2 years again. And then I was getting a little antsy to be a sous chef. And in hindsight, and I hope all you young cooks who are listening hear this, I wish I'd gone to work for one more chef. I mean, not anymore. I'm fine with my decisions. Yeah. But I think I could have used one more or two more years gaining some more skills in a really...
So now you've been working 4 years.
Six total.
Six total. So what were the skills that you would have learned if you went those two more years?
I think just another style for one, another style from another chef. I don't know, maybe more butchering skills, maybe more cooking on a line skill, maybe more organizational skills, refining skills that I already had, not being so antsy. And I tell cooks today, and I even tell sous chefs today, like, don't rush it. Because once you get to a certain level, it's really hard to go back. You get to a sous chef level, and all of a sudden you're making more money, and you've tied yourself into a lease where your rent is equivalent with that money. And a lot of think factors happen. And I always tell people to really take their time. And I really took my time. I mean, Avoce is my first... I was executive chef of Spiaggia, but I had Tony as a chef partner with me. And so, you know, the titles are semantics. And in a lot of ways, I was Tony's chef, and which I appreciated a lot. And Avoce is really my first gig on my own. And I'm 40. I took that gig when I was 38. So, you know, that's late for a chef. But yeah. I really took the time to educate myself. And I really encourage people to do that. But I was antsy to get a sous chef job, and I felt like I wanted that responsibility. But I was only 26, mm-hmm. and so in hindsight, I don't know what I was so antsy about. And I went to the Lobster Club. I went back to work for Anne. I heard.
But you want to tell the little story about March and, you know.
Oh, they hired Mike story?
Yeah, your Mike story.
Yes, let's preface it that Mike and I get along really well now. Mike Anthony, who's the chef and partner of Gramercy Tavern, who I respect more than anyone, became the sous chef. The sous chef was leaving March. I had worked at March for a year. I was a young cook with a little bit of an ego and thought that I should be the sous chef. And I didn't get the job, and they brought in Mike, who had worked in Japan and France and for Danielle. And I was like, who is this guy? And he was tough. Mike was really tough, and he was tough on me, and he changed the nature of the kitchen a little bit, and I'm not sure I was ready for that. And my time was sort of up at March also. I was ready to go, but I think that...
But, you know, if I can steer you a little bit, I know that you felt you were ready for sous chef of that restaurant. And then you had... You said to me, he came in and I realized why I wasn't...
Absolutely. I definitely realized that I was not ready for that, and yes, that Mike was really talented and much more experienced than I was. And he deserved the job 100%. And like I said, this is 15 years later. I'm right. telling the story.
Right.
I was 26 at the time and a little shit, as I said to you, on the way over here.
Yes. And I think that's important for young chefs to
hear. Admittedly, a little shit. So Mike and I, like I said, are very, very friendly now and really get along and really respect each other. And I think it's pretty awesome.
So when do you know that you're ready? Because I see a lot of young chefs and they think they're ready when they're not. And they're waiting to bust out of the gate. When are you ready?
Well, I remember when I was upset that I didn't get the job at March. And I was talking to someone. I think he had been the former chef de cuisine. I don't remember. And I ran into him and I was upset. And he said, are you the best cook in the kitchen there? Are you the most skilled cook in the kitchen? And I said, no, not at all. And he said, then you shouldn't be the sous chef.
Good statement.
Though. And that stuck with me a lot. And I've you know, listen, I've made mistakes of making people my sous chefs who maybe they have the perseverance or maybe they have the drive, but maybe they don't have the skill level. And in all honesty, when I've made people sous chefs in my kitchens that don't have the skill level, it really backfires. It backfires on them because they're not comfortable and mm-hmm. they're gunning for a job that they're not ready for. Mm-hmm. And it backfires on me because they can't lead my cooks mm-hmm. and the cooks end up not respecting them. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it happen a couple times, so that's where sort of the patience thing came in. And I'm happy I didn't get the sous chef job at March, because I wouldn't have done well, mm-hmm. and I would have let Wayne down, mm-hmm. and I would have let myself down, and I would have let cooks down who wouldn't have respected me. Mm-hmm. So now
you've gone back to... You didn't get the sous chef job, so you leave. And where do you go back to?
I went back to Anne. Jen Sism at the time was leaving, I think. She was the chef de cuisine, and someone else was moving into her spot. And I mm-hmm. knew there was a sous chef spot opening, so I called Anne and I said, I want the sous chef spot. And she said, great. But I knew Anne's food really well. Mm-hmm. I had worked at the Lobster Club actually in the front of the house for a couple months when I was at Arcadia, just trying to learn that end of it. I was a mm-hmm. hostess and a reservationist, mm-hmm. I learned that I don't want to be a hostess or a reservationist, and that I should be in the back of the house. But cooking at the Lobster Club was a very different kind of restaurant than at March, and the skill level required was very different, and I was comfortable there. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have been comfortable with the tasks that I needed to do at March in hindsight. So
here you're talking about styles of chefs, and Anne and Wayne were just very different. And so it's
really
very
different.
Interesting, because a restaurant isn't the same, and chefs are not the same.
Right, and being a sous chef at one place isn't the same as being a chef de cuisine maybe at another place. And, you know,
so how did you get, I want to move us along, we could spend hours on
this. We sure
could. Yeah. At Spiaggi, when you got the chef's position, what was that transition like?
Well, that was many years later. That mm-hmm. was after 3.5 years at the Soho Grand Hotel, which no one talks about, but well, was very significant in my career, actually.
How did you go to a hotel after Anne?
I came back. Well, I left Anne and went to Italy. And Anne and her husband helped me go to Italy, actually. They set me up in places, and I went and lived there for 6 months.
Why Italy, not France or Spain?
I was afraid of French kitchens, and I had traveled to both, and I connected with Italian food. And that was really the bottom line, and I just really, really loved Italian food. And so I went to Italy and I cooked and I came back and...
You cooked in a restaurant?
I cooked in several restaurants. I worked and traveled and kind of moved once a month and learned Italian while I was there and lived with cooks. And it was this really, really, like, probably the best experience of my life from a personal perspective of just going to a foreign country and not knowing the language at all and living with the people I worked with and having to communicate with them and having to learn a new culture and having to learn a new cuisine.
was really, really an incredible experience that I wish I had done when I was younger, because I was 20. I turned 29 when I was there, and I think if I had done it when I was 25 and living above restaurants and all that stuff would have been a little bit more appealing. But I think I was sort of on that cusp of wanting a real life, but it was an incredible experience. So I came home, and John DeLucy had just taken the executive chef job of the Soho Grand, and he said I ran into him, and I had just gotten home. He said, "Oh, I need a sous chef." And I said, "I'm not going to work in a hotel. You have to be kidding me." And I went, I staged, and John's charming and really convincing. And he convinced me. And I thought, I had worked in all these Upper East Side restaurants. And I was like, okay, I want to see something hip. I've never done this hip thing. And the Soho Grand at the time was very on hip, fire and hip. And I said, okay, I'm going to be cool. I'm going to go work downtown. And you know what? The Soho Grand culinarily was not a pivotal part of my career, but from a management perspective, I had never read a spreadsheet before. I got to read P&Ls for the first time. I had to manage a big staff. I had to work in a corporate environment, which I had never done. So it really led me to that, and I never loved it. I looked for jobs all the time. I was constantly online looking for jobs. I was constantly talking to people and always kind of searching for the next best thing, and a headhunter called me that I had been in touch with when I got back from Italy and said, "Hey, I have the perfect gig for you. It's in Chicago."
Okay, let me ask you one question. We're gonna cut for a break. But how essential is it for a chef to read a spreadsheet and a P&L? And how essential is that in your being the chef of Avoce today?
You know, unfortunately, it's really, really important. And I think chefs don't realize it, and young cooks don't realize it. But running a restaurant, running a kitchen is a business. And whether it's for yourself or for an owner, you're there to make money for that person or for yourself, and you have to have a successful business. So to understand the financials is really important, and whether you like it or not, which it's not my favorite thing to do, and I don't think it's any chef's favorite thing to do, it's a really, really, really essential part of the job.
And you have to know that to be a chef.
You do.
Because you're on the bottom line. Okay, we're going to cut here, and we're going to come back, and we're going to continue the story.
Great.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
I love that music for you. You know, that's our theme song. It's Andrew White from, he's in New Zealand now, but I met him up in Cape Breton Island. And thank you, Andrew, for letting us use that. I'm speaking today to Missy Robbins, the chef of the much appreciated and vaunted Voce restaurant in New York City in Columbus Circle and on East 26th in Madison. So, your story is so incredible, you know, the journey. I think it's so important. I think we're just going to get through your journey, and I'm going
to
ask you to come back, and we're going
to
talk philosophy.
Sounds good to me.
So So now you've been headhunted to go to and to be at chef. So you've had the chef job at the Soho Grand. That was your first leap, and you learned business skills. And now you're going off to Chicago again.
Yeah.
So did Chicago play into it? Did you say, okay, I know that city, I can live there?
Yeah, or was it the job itself? I had told him, the headhunter, that when I came back from Italy, I was very adventurous. And I said, oh, I'll live in San Francisco, I'll live here. I was feeling very adventurous. And he remembered that I said I would live in Chicago. My brother has lived in Chicago for 15 years. My mom's from there. My grandmother lived there most of my life. So it was very familiar to me. And in my head, I thought it was a little New York, which it's not.
We'll go there later.
We can go there later. But you know, I said, okay, well, I may as well apply. And so I had a 2-hour phone interview with Tony, which I found out much later that he got off the, it was a Sunday, so he was at home and his wife was in the apartment, and he got off the phone and he said, God, I hope she can cook. We had an amazing, amazing connection on the phone. I had eaten at a lot of the places he had worked in Italy, and you know, I just, there was a connection there, and I really liked him. And so he flew me out there to do a tasting, and it was only the second tasting I ever had to do, and it was really scary. And I wasn't an Italian chef, you have to remember. I had spent time in Italy, but 6 months out of a 12-year, whatever, span, 9 years, however long I'd been cooking at the time, 9 years probably, isn't very long. And I was really versed in American food, but had this love of Italian food. So I had to, like, really think, what am I going to cook for this guy? And if you've ever met Tony, he's very poker-faced. So he came in, he said, I am Tony Mantovano. And I started cooking, and with every course that went out, he got more and more poker-faced. And I said, oh my God, I'm totally blowing this. Totally blowing this. And then afterwards, he started introducing me to people and had other people interview me. And I'm like, I guess I didn't blow it. And almost by the end of the day, I had a job offer. Not official, but sort of a strong interest. And 5 weeks later, I moved there. And I started as the chef de cuisine, and they changed my title about 2 months later to executive chef.
And tell people what that means.
Really, it's semantics. I mean, in this particular case, in this particular case, but chef de cuisine is sort of the person who does all the day-to-day things in a restaurant when there's a chef, an executive chef, or a chef partner. I have two very important chef de cuisines at both of Oche's who make me look really good every day.
So the chef de cuisine is really in charge of doing the day-to-day cooking.
My chef de cuisines are extremely involved in menus. So at this point, I mean, they've both been with me for almost four years in some capacity or another, and they're really a part of Avoce and a part of my cuisine, and our kind of the three of us, our cuisines have combined, and that's sort of what happened with Tony. I mean, I was cooking Tony's food, and eventually my food became Tony's food, and Tony's food became my food, and I was with him for 5 years. So after 5 years, you don't really know whose food you're cooking anymore, and you've morphed together, and hopefully you have a synergy that's working like that. And that's what's happened with my chef de cuisines at Avoce, is that they both have sort of they've pushed me to become a different chef, and I've pushed them to be a different chef, and combined we make really good food.
So as the executive chef of Spiaggia and getting all that recognition, how do you leave after 5 years?
I really wanted to come back to New York. And Tony knew that. At about year three in my review, he sat down, and we were very close, Tony and I, and we still are very close. We're doing a dinner together that we donated to the James Beard Foundation for their auction next week. So we're cooking together. It'd be really cool. We're very close, and he's still my mentor and all of that, and a good friend and kind of like family. And at year three, he sat me down. He said, so what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know, I want to open my own place and I want to go back to New York. And he said, okay, we'll make that happen.
That's a smart boss. I mean, you know, an owner, knowing that you need to get back, let's do it together.
Yeah, so we talked a lot about it. And I, when the Avoce position came along, I was deep into trying to find a space in New York. And Tony was sort of being an advisor and going to be a potential partner. And I was deep into it. And Tony was really supportive, but it really had to do with going back to New York. If Spiaggia was in New York, I probably would have never left if they had been willing to make me a partner or something, or I probably would have stayed a long time. Chicago never felt like home to me for whatever reason, and New York really was kind of calling back for me to be there.
Well, yeah, and you're from Connecticut, and it is sort of...
Yeah, it was also, again, going back to the drive thing. I felt like I could open 10 restaurants in Chicago and be very successful. But for me internally, I thought that I would never feel successful unless my success came from doing it in New York. And I needed to try and see if I could be a big shot in New York. And for whatever reason, whatever drive I have, I haven't figured that out yet. That was something that was really important. I think it probably comes from having cooked here under all these amazing chefs. And that's where I kind of grew up in the cooking world. So it was really hard to leave Spiaggia. I mean, I remember my last night, and I went to thank everyone, and I cried, and it was super hard, and I think it was hard for Tony, and I think it was hard for both of us, but I knew it was the right thing, and I knew at some point I had to go try and be a chef without a John DeLucy over me and without a Tony over me and see if I could cook on my own and cook and develop my own style and be Missy Robbins without someone else. And it wasn't that I didn't like working for Tony or whatever. I just wanted to see if I could do it on my own.
So now Avoce. These are the owners of Avoce. Your partners are from London.
Mm-hmm.
You obviously didn't know them before they approached you.
I didn't know them. There was a guy named Andrew Carmelini, I think everyone's familiar with.
Is he Dutch? He has an Italian name.
I was having a rough day at work, and I was at Spiaggia, and I was frustrated, and I was talking to a fellow chef of mine who at the time was living in Vegas. He was a friend of mine from Chicago, but he was in Vegas, and I was on the phone with him, and I was bitching, and my door was shut. I mean, I had an office the size of this at Spiaggia, and I shut my door. It was like in a closet, and I was mad about something. He said, you know, Carmelini's leaving Avoce. You should apply. And I said, I'll never. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I just read it on Eater. And I said, oh, whatever, Eater, you know.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be true, and I applied, thinking I would never in a million years get the job. I was a Chicago chef. I was under someone else. I never thought that they'd even reply to me. And sure enough, they replied in a day and flew out the next week to do a tasting at Spiaggia, which was really awkward, obviously.
Yes.
But I was very honest and told Tony, and mm-hmm. I said, this is happening. If you don't want it to happen, let me know.
Mm-hmm.
Tony was very gracious. Mm. He stayed to kind of check them out.
Mm-hmm. That was nice of him.
And then he left and the tasting, and then I met with them the next morning and again came back. I was very clear with them that I needed to give significant notice, and I gave Tony 4 months notice, which is really long.
Yes, that's really hard.
And but I mean I had to. That restaurant was really, it was family, and I needed to make sure that I left that restaurant well taken care of, and whoever was going to take my position well trained, and all of that.
It's great. So now you get to New York, and it's
Avoce, I'm terrified.
Right, and you're in the Shark Tank. Let's call it what it is.
Yeah.
The Shark Tank with the New York press and the New York diner and the heavy competition. So what happened?
It was a tough 6 months, the first 6 months. I mean, filling Andrew's shoes. I mean, Andrew's a big chef in New York and really with an incredible reputation. And I think a lot of people wanted to see Avoce fail, and no one knew who I was. Chicagoans knew who I was. My family knows who I am. My friends know who I am. But I wasn't who I am today,
right,
in terms of notoriety. And it was Andrew's whole staff was still at the restaurant. So I walked into the staff that didn't want to necessarily work for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they wanted to work for anyone. They're very
other
loyal
than Andrew.
Yeah, and they're still with him, most of them. Which
so
is
they
a,
all left?
Eventually,
yeah.
About 6 months later, mm-hmm. Which is a huge tribute to Andrew, and mm-hmm. it impresses me still to this day that those people all still work for him. I think it's really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was tough. I mean, I was this person trying. I knew that I had to do well. And I knew that I had to cook food that was familiar to me and not kind of go too outside the box, because I wanted to make sure that I was cooking well. It was tough, but the economy also went to hell a month after I started, 3 weeks after I started. So I started September 15th, and the market crashed 3 weeks later, and the restaurant was doing a lot less covers, and I didn't know if it was because of me or because of the economy, and you don't know, and you feel really weird and awkward. I just kept plugging away, and the accolades started coming in, and people liked what I was doing, and I just kept trying to do what I do, and I think things really changed for me when Andrew's team started leaving, and I got to hire my own people who really related to me. And once I hired my first sous chef, who's now my chef de cuisine, Hillary, and Jeremy was my other sous chef that I hired, who became the opening chef de cuisine at Columbus, who's no longer with me, but still a good friend. And they really changed a Voce for me and made it a place that was like, okay, I can do this. These people believe in me and they really like me. And we started hiring our own cooks and it all started kind of flowing. So it took some time.
How was it different being your own executive chef, not having Tony there, not having to share ideas?
Really hard. Still really hard. I mean, still now I'm the person that people look to. And you have to have the answers, and you have to act like you have the answers if you don't have the answers. And you know, if something wasn't good at Spiaggia or a dish wasn't good or something, I had Tony as a buffer. Or if something wasn't good business-wise, or if there was a management problem, or if there was a problem with a cook, there was always someone to go to. And especially because, you know, there is a corporate structure at a Voce, and there's a director of operations, and there are people to go to, but the owners don't live here. And so it was really different for me and a really hard adjustment, but one that I knew like I could push through. And that and Tony, listen, I still called him for the first 6 months very frequently and asked him a lot of questions. And I also really felt like I needed to cook differently. People kept saying like, oh, how much of Spiaggia are we going to see at a Voce? And I said, hopefully not very much. I mean, I didn't want to cook Spiaggia food, but Spiaggia food was so ingrained in me that I didn't necessarily know how to not cook Spiaggia food. And I still think my food's very...
So how do you describe a Voce today? When people say, what kind of restaurant do you...
Contemporary Italian.
But what is it about your contemporary Italian that makes it different from anybody else's?
I think we really like to take... I mean, we do a lot of research into regional Italian cuisine. And one of my experiences when I lived over there was that I lived in three different regions, and I really got...
Which were they?
I lived in Friuli, Emilia-Romagna, and Tuscany. And so I think... And traveled in the Veneto, and I traveled a lot. So I think... I really got to understand that every region is a different cuisine in Italy, and no two are alike. So we really try and kind of bring food to Italian food to a level where people aren't necessarily familiar with what we do. I had two couples last night at a Voce Columbus that said that were from Amsterdam, and they said they flew from Europe just to eat. They had read about a Voce, and they came just to eat at a Voce. Whether that's true or not, it was a really nice thing to say. And they said they loved it. They said, but your food's really different than the food in Italy. And I said, well, not really. I said, what we do is we take really sort of rustic ideas and rustic or traditional concepts and ingredients and sort of elevate them to a different level without manipulating them too much. And so it takes some explaining sometimes to make people understand, listen, we have people come into a Voce and they get mad that we don't have meatballs on the menu.
Right.
And they're expecting something that doesn't exist in what we do. But I think if you can get people on board with understanding that Italian food really ranges and is kind of like 20 different cuisines, then they get really excited about it.
What are you most proud of?
Developing other chefs, to be honest with you. You know, I have a large team. I have 5 sous chefs at one restaurant, 2 sous chefs in another restaurant, 2 chef de cuisines, and watching sort of building teams and sort of watching them grow and watching them make me grow. And that sort of evolution is proud. I'm really proud to have 2 successful restaurants and walk out into the dining room and see a full dining room on a Tuesday night of 200 people. And I mean, it's a pretty incredible feeling, and sometimes you take it for granted if you don't walk around the dining room a lot. And sometimes I'm stuck in that kitchen and I don't come out because I'm too busy. And you know, last night was a great example. I walked out to say hi to one person and I ended up in the dining room for 45 minutes. Just with people kind of saying hi, chef, and whatever, and those moments sort of make you kind of pinch yourself and say, "Wow, this is pretty cool." But really, the developing teams and being able to create a cuisine with those people is sort of what keeps me going.
You promise to come back?
Absolutely.
All right, we went over 7 minutes, but it was worth
every
minute. Thank you, Missy.
Thank
See you next time.
Thank
this
you.
Is Dorothy Pan Hamilton.
Yay.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.